Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something to help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, temperance, and wisdom. And then here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers. We explore at length how these Stoic ideas can be applied to our actual lives and the challenging issues of our time. Here on the weekend, when you have a little bit more space, when things have slowed down, be sure to take some time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with your journal, and most importantly, to prepare for what the week ahead may bring. I'm just about to go into the studio to record my latest audiobook. My wife and I have been listening to audiobooks. We've been listening to audiobooks in the car as a family just to keep our kids off screens because Audible is amazing. And Audible is also the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next to listen recommendations to satisfy every type of thriller listener. If you want breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that will enthrall you, even brand new and exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, well, then you want to check out Audible. My wife and I were just raving about this true crime audiobook that we read called Furious Hours. And then I've been raving about this book, Night of the Grizzlies, which I loved. Audio piques the imagination and it brings thrillers to life. And as an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now.
Hey, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. I was reading a New York Times piece a couple weeks ago, and it was talking about how misinformation particularly spreads through smaller local news websites. So I'm going to read you this little paragraph, and it was talking about just how there's something like 1,700 local television stations in the United States, 3,300 radio stations, 1,300 daily papers, 5,800 weekly newspapers all over the United States. And it says, Joe Liquido, an assistant journalism professor who studies disinformation at the University of Texas at Austin, said local media is often a starting point that creates a trading up the chain effect. The article goes on, it starts when a rumor is covered or published in local media, she said, where it can then gain a sheen of credibility. Then, quote, when you pitch it to a Fox News or a larger news platform, you can say that this other outlet covered it, so it must be real. Well, this caught me off guard because not only is this jived with what I've seen over the course of the pandemic, but as far as I understood, I coined the phrase trading up the chain. It's in the first chapter of my first book, Trust Me, I'm Lying. It was me watching how rumors or gossip or things that started on blogs would get sort of laundered through a local news site or social media and then get picked up by increasingly large websites until it was a breaking story on CNN or Fox News or NBC News or whatever. This is something I've been wanting to talk to you guys about because as the Daily Stoic platform has grown, I was just talking to my wife about this the other day. This was a small group originally. It was a small, nerdy group of people who were really interested in ancient philosophy. But as the books have gotten bigger and bigger and sold now millions of copies, not everyone is coming to it from the same place. Not everyone is familiar with all the assumptions or the teachings of Stoicism. And certainly, they're not all going to be dealing with the same deck of cards as far as media literacy goes. So it's been, I don't want to say distressing, but it's been strange and disappointing to watch some of the vehement reactions to pretty basic historical stuff that we have talked about on Daily Stoic, particularly this Marcus Aurelius quote I love that Marcus wrote during the Antonine Plague. And we've talked about our sort of Stoic obligations to each other. We've talked about just sort of basic human decency. And also, I mean, I care about you guys. I don't want anything bad to happen to you. And so I've tried to sort of use my platform to talk about some basic safety protocol things. And it's been strange to watch some of the insane reactions that these things have garnered. And if you don't have to take my word for it, just go look at some of the Instagram comments or the YouTube comments on stuff that we've done and wrap your mind around that this is what you're seeing that wasn't deleted or banned or reported, right? This is like the stuff that passed muster or that just frankly wore down the people on my team to the point where they're like, I got to move on and focus on things that actually matter. So clearly there's a certain percentage of people who listen to this, who have come into my work and are, as Marcus would say, infected in one way or another, or are vulnerable to misinformation. And so in today's episode, I wanted to talk to Professor Liquido and talk about how information spreads, talk about how we can protect ourselves against it, talk about how we can notice when it's happening, and talk about what our ethical obligations are as individuals and as members of society to do something about it. I thought this was a great conversation. I really enjoyed having it. Took me back all the way to my first book, which is crazy to me that I wrote in 2011. Trust Me, I'm Lying, now almost 10 years old. You can pick up a copy at my bookstore, The Painted Porch, or at thepaintedporch.com, or anywhere books are sold. There's an audiobook version as well. Professor Liquido studies cross-platform media language in the context of global politics. She especially focuses on interactions between news and social media, and she studies language processing and does mass quantitative language analysis to study how ideas or concepts or words spread through these platforms. She studies political mis and disinformation. There's a big difference as we talk about, and she's been published everywhere from the Columbia Journalism Review and appeared on CNN. She was also cited in Robert Mueller's 2018 report on the interference in the 2016 election. She studies live tweeting, economic news coverage, public diplomacy, and coverage of U.S. foreign policy. She received her PhD from the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2020, where she also has PhD minors in English linguistics and political science. She knows her stuff, and she is a new Austin resident, so it was wonderful to talk to her. I think you're really going to like this interview, and I'll leave you to it. So I came across you. I was reading a piece in the New York Times, and I'm going to riff on it at the intro of the episode so people will have some context. But you were talking about, you mentioned about how information is traded up the chain, which I was so excited to see because as far as I know, I made up that phrase.
Yes, my understanding is that you did coin that phrase.
And so I was like, wow, I wrote that book so long ago. It's not what I think about all the time. Although in other aspects, unfortunately, I do have to think about it all the time. But it was like, oh, wow, this is exactly what I was talking about. And to see someone like you studying it from a sort of a scholarly perspective and explaining how it's happening in real time, it was both encouraging and alarming to me at the same time. But why don't we start with how you, your understanding of that concept and how you've seen it in your work.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's funny you mentioned that you haven't really thought about it all too hard in maybe more recent years, because it's been on my mind probably nonstop for the past 2 years or so. And I'm a researcher who uses primarily computational methods to study cross-platform media flows. So I'm mm-hmm. really curious about how language or links or memes, all variations of human communication, flow from different social media platforms, but also between social media and news. And so a lot of my work during, you know, in 2016 and 2017 were really focused on how, for example, Russian trolls ended up getting into news media.
Yeah.
And a lot of that activity, at the time, I realized, you know, this is an interesting link to explore. The one where, you know, news organizations are really looking through social media and trying to find, you know, interesting stories to cover or opinions of the public, that sort of thing. And I realized that this push and pull goes both ways, right? And this is where mm-hmm. I kind of came across your concept of trading up the chain, this idea that a story can be dropped in like a social media post or a blog and then pitched repeatedly from a small news organization a niche platform or a digital platform into one that's larger. And so I've been trying to follow that trend, particularly when it comes to political misinformation. But of course, you know, during the pandemic, that also includes COVID misinformation.
Yeah, it's kind of alarming when if you watch just a single story unfold, like if you were like there when it happened. I think part of a good portion of our sort of dysfunction about media, I think, has to do with just how rarely people actually sort of encounter it happening.
Oh,
but
yeah.
If you ever, like, you happen to be the subject of a big news story, or you witness an event that becomes a media story, or in your case, you're studying it, it's quite alarming at just sort of how quickly, you know, like the sort of the thing can go from this one place or this somewhat spurious or speculative place mm-hmm. to like all of a sudden like heads of state are reacting to it as if it's the most established, you know, well sussed out thing in the world.
Absolutely. And I think the speed is really the tricky part. In the past, these sort of processes might have taken a little bit longer, or you would have need to have more power to have, you know, the ear of a journalist or someone who can cover it and expand that to their audience. But now it's very easy through social media. And so that process is just so quickly and easily exploited. And in my own research, when I study platforms like Telegram and Parler, for example, yeah. where the alt-right and sometimes white nationalists and QAnoners and other conspiratorial individuals, where they're active, you can really see that that organization in real time, which was really shocking. There was one example I remember of a Telegram channel that was discussing a piece of fake news that they were hoping to promote on Twitter. And the piece ended up going quite viral on Twitter. I'm trying to remember what it was about. It was a little far back. It was like sometime 2018 and 2019. And the people on Telegram were actually discussing how to promote that activity on Twitter. So they would post the tweet and encourage other folks on Telegram to retweet it, and would also give updates anytime, for example, a prominent Twitter user or a verified Twitter user would retweet it, or when a news media organization would cover it.
It's weird, because when I was writing the book, I was trying to sort of say, like, look, here's how this happens. Mm-hmm. This is probably not good. And it could be used like, hey, if you have a charity, you know, here's how you could get publicity for it. Or here, if you have some, you know, cause you're trying to get sure. publicity for, here's how this works. And then I think what the alarming thing has been, I'm curious, maybe you disagree, mm-hmm. but it really feels like these groups, the sort of, whether you're talking about Russian trolls or sort of political disruptors, it's almost as if they're more media fluent in how these things work than not just the public, but it seems like even the outlets that they end up exploiting seem to be relatively ignorant of this process, and that's why it keeps happening.
Yes, I think one of the things that I get worried about is when news outlets don't have a lot of verification practices, especially for social media content. And one of the things that is scary to me is, you know, when folks pitch things to a news organization, or when a news organization sees something on social media, they don't necessarily check the source of it or reach out to the person who's actually posting it to make sure, you know, is that a genuine human being? Is that, you know, content that they genuinely believe in, so on and so forth. And so I don't know. My hope is that news organizations change that over time, but I acknowledge that that's a hard process to try to verify every individual on social media.
Well, I saw this happen somewhat recently. This is a more positive example, mm-hmm. but I think the illustration is what should alarm people. So I live out here in Bastrop, and I donated some money to get this Confederate statue moved. And I just took a picture of it, and I posted like what I'd done on Instagram. And then someone had posted that on the Austin subreddit. And then literally within like 20 minutes, I got tweets from like DMs on Twitter from local reporters who wanted to interview me about it. And then the same thing happened. I have a bookstore here, and this mm-hmm. woman came in and sort of had this big stink about wearing a mask. And then she sent us this really nasty letter about it. And so I posted the letter also mm-hmm. on social media. And again, it goes from social, like yes. my personal social media, where I could do whatever I wanted with it. I could have Photoshopped it. I could have changed it,
yeah.
right? Like the donation could have been fake in the other case. And right. then that goes to Reddit, which again, there's no vetting.
Nope.
But then then immediately you're getting inquiries from reporters who are like, they're almost like Uber drivers outside of an airport, just waiting for passengers to land so they can grab a ride. Like, I don't think people understand.
Yeah,
I don't think people understand just how much like anticipation and waiting there is to like scoop up anything sensational or provocative, and how 99% of the time this works out. The person is not being disingenuous or misleading, but
every so often,
yes.
Exactly. And, you know, I think a lot of folks don't realize how much, for example, journalists really rely on Twitter for any of their newsmaking at this point, even if it's for factual information or for opinions, right? And so one of the things that I've noticed in talking to a lot of journalists is they wake up with Twitter, they go to bed with Twitter, and they're constantly DMing and reaching out to people. And even in the examples that you provided, you know, the content you're sharing is hopping across so many social media platforms, sometimes in the form of links, but very often in the form of images, which are much easier to manipulate and much harder to verify.
Right. Yes. And it feels like, okay, so it went social, like it went from Instagram to Reddit
to Twitter.
Yeah. That feels like it's being vetted, but these are four platforms with zero vetting, right? Like,
So
we think that as it goes up the chain, it's being vetted, but it's like, actually no one is vetting because they're just assuming the person underneath them did it.
Exactly. And one of the scariest things is that, you know, instead of it being vetted, the process for whether something is worth reporting on ends up becoming much more about whether it's popular, right? And a lot of people, you know, liked it on Instagram or upvoted it on Reddit or retweeted it on Twitter, that has become the indicator of whether something is newsworthy or worth covering because it's, you know, provocative or interesting or gets a lot of reactions from folks. And so unfortunately, what we see is that vetting process has now been replaced with a virality process, essentially.
So when you just talk to us a little bit about like sort of how you see stuff trading up the chain, like what is it, certain kinds of information? Is it certain people who are as you study this phenomenon, what are you seeing? COVID, election, or, you know, sort of any types of news? How does this typically happen?
Well, you know, I'm glad that you mentioned in most cases, a lot of this information isn't necessarily bad. Like, you know, good information can also be traded up the chain. But I obviously specialize in misinformation, disinformation, because I'm worried when that kind of information is traded up the chain. And if this year has shown us anything, it's that, you know, malicious information or polarizing information can spread rather quickly. And there's been research evidence showing that false information, especially when it's emotionally laden, especially when it's rather dramatic or polarizing, that tends to spread much faster than factually accurate information. And so when you think about that sort of pattern in relation to trading up the chain, it makes a lot of sense, tragically, that misinformation, in particular about COVID, but also about the election, ends up being very easily traded up the chain. From my research, I found that a lot of times this stuff will start on smaller platforms or smaller groups and communities. So, for example, one particular subreddit or a Telegram channel or on Parler, and then they will try to move it towards a larger social media platform, typically a bigger subreddit, Twitter, obviously, because there are a lot of journalists on Twitter, and Facebook. And this is where it will then get picked up by journalists, sometimes by smaller journalists who then, you know, give it attention for larger newsrooms. But sometimes it just jumps straight up to, you know, a Fox News, CNN, New York Times type platform.
Yeah, I think when I was writing this, and it's crazy to me that I was writing, trust me, I'm lying, in 2011. Mm-hmm. And a lot of what I was observing had happened, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009. But it is remarkable just what a stable link in that chain sort of local news seems to be, or sort of regional news. Because I think, is it that there's hundreds of years of sort of equity in those brands? Why is it that, you know, people care about, you know, the local NBC station or the local this or that? Why do they seem to be specifically such a conduit for the kind of information that then escalates to national news or goes viral on social media?
Yeah, I think it's two trends. So first, people generally trust local news media more than they trust national news media, even if they are consuming more national news media. So there is this equity that comes in from being a local newsroom and reporting on stories locally. But at the same time, these local newsrooms are the ones that suffer the most when it comes to, you know, newsroom cuts and funding cuts. And so right. a lot of these newsrooms have really struggled in finding the resources to actually verify a lot of this information. And then are kind of encouraged, if not just straight out told to, you know, share a story coming from the mother organization, right? The larger corporation. So for example, when I talk to a lot of folks, they don't realize that most of their local newspapers are now owned by Gannett, for example. They think that it's still part of their, you know, local newsroom, and it's the same as it's always been because the name has been around for 50 years or so. But 10 years right. ago, it was picked up by Gannett. And as a result, a lot of the stories that you'll see in a Gannett type newspaper are the same newspapers that are the same news stories that you see in USA Today and in other Gannett newspapers. So if you have someone share a piece of misinformation and that tweet gets embedded into a USA Today story, it might end up on hundreds of local newspaper websites, right? But folks don't necessarily realize it's because it's all linked through Gannett.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80. And I think the other thing people don't necessarily realize, and I don't mean to disparage these local reporters, but these are not usually seasoned journalists with many decades of experience the way that they once were. Usually, it's almost as if media has its own chain where you're sort of like if you would start at, you know, a local broadcaster in Des Moines, but you're very quickly trying to get up to the national level. So yes. These people are kind of they're either early in their career or they are trying to go places in their career. And that's a real factor in influencing what and how they cover what they cover.
Yes, a lot of them tend to be inexperienced, or the ones that are experienced who have been doing it for a long time, you know, they are more expensive to pay. And so they're the ones who end up getting cut the fastest. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I've noticed in the local newsroom space is that a lot of media corporations are doing this sort of consolidation where not only are they consolidating all the newspapers under one newspaper, but they'll also give that newspaper kind of a niche. So you have to focus on sports, and this other space has to focus on, you know, political reporting. And so what you see is a noticeable decrease in the number of people who are covering one thing, right? They end up just assigning it to one person. And so you get this kind of siloing that results in less verification. It results in fewer people actually covering the story. And what ends up looking like local news is actually much more like regional or state level news.
Yeah. And a lot of these outlets don't, like, I've never gone to KXAN.com, which would be a local, you know, Austin news site, right? Like, I don't pull that up to read the news, but I do read a lot of their reporting because it gets passed to me, right? Like, I'll see it on Reddit, or friends will be texting it around. So the other sort of factor that I think is operating on the news that people don't necessarily think about is, and you mentioned how sort of emotionally laden news tends to spread best, that the stories are dependent on, are they passed from person to person? So, insert complicated concept does not spread well. You know, insert sad concept doesn't usually, like, it tends to be aggravating, frustrating, disappointing, outrageous, tragic. You know, it's the high valence stuff.
Totally. Yeah. I like the way that you put it, high valence stuff. And it's things that are really simple to explain and very emotionally charged. And with COVID, I think that's one area where you see a lot of misinformation spreading for those exact two reasons. Because obviously, you know, COVID and the pandemic is a complicated thing, both medically, but also in terms of, like, how do we as a society deal with it economically, socially, et cetera. And if someone can provide a simple answer, like, you know, before the vaccine, when everyone was talking about hydroxychloroquine and all of the solutions, it's really easy for that stuff to spread on social media where it is unvetted and then unintentionally or intentionally gets picked up by a news organization, right? And so the news organization not only takes cues from what's popular and what's popular in discussion on these platforms, but then they turn it around. And when they produce a news story about it, their hope is that they can kind of jump on that bandwagon and get more traction for their news stories because they're talking about something that is popular, even if it is unverified.
Well, and we've gotten to a place where we're sort of so polarized as a society, and there's always certain interest groups that want either certain things to be true because they believe it, because they're trying to advance some agenda, because they're crazy, whatever it is. So I think this is also where the trading up the chain thing happens, where, like, okay, let's say there's a certain percent of the population that believes this should be a thing, or they believe this viewpoint. Well, they only have to get, like, let's say there's 1,000 local news websites in the United States. They just have to get one to pick it up, right? And and then it's relevant to not just the people in Des Moines, Iowa, or Birmingham, Alabama, but then it's like that it was picked up by a local news outlet confirms what they already believed, right? And then it gives them something they can then pass to other people to propagate this view. So in the same way that a marketer goes, okay, I want people to talk about this movie or talk about this product that I have, they're like, I just need one outlet to cover it. There was a great publicist named Michael Citrick, and he was saying that every campaign, you need a lead steer, right? Like, one steer starts
the stampede.
Oh, yeah,
that's a good way to frame it.
And so it's like you basically have this vested interest or this energy that just needs one reporter under however much pressure to write one story for one local news outlet. And it's off to the races because now, you know, all over the world, the people who are interested in that thing can be sharing it and it drives it to the top of the leaderboard and then they're posting on. It becomes this whole thing.
Yes. And I think that's true for a lot of media communication, right? So for example, you found me through a New York Times article and then you reached out for me to come to this podcast.
Yes.
And there's a lot of examples of that, of anytime I end up in the news or if I write something for, you know, Wired or Vox or something, because other news organizations or other folks who are in the media are paying attention to that and just, you know, seeing what's up and they might have seen it on Twitter or on Reddit or something. And this is how I end up making a lot of contacts with other folks in the media organization. But it's through very similar processes.
Yes.
I wanted to go back to this comment you had earlier about how political our, you know, media environment has become, our social environment has become. And I think that polarization is not just really important for thinking about what information flows where, but it's really important to think about because they are so, a lot of the things that get shared are polarizing towards the other person, right? And okay. So, for example, I think disinformation actors exploit this kind of polarization all the time by showing, by producing content, for example, that makes the other political group look bad.
Yes.
So to give you an example, there was a Russian troll that I was following in 2016 named 10 GOP, which is short for Tennessee GOP. They were impersonating. Yep. Yep. They were Russian. They were pretending to be a Tennessee GOP account. And they had found this picture. There was a person in Ohio. His name is Chris McNeil. He's kind of like a shock jock. He focuses mostly on sports. And one of the things he really likes to do is he pretends to take pictures of sports games and then he tells other people that they are actually political campaigns. And he does this a fair number of times. So in a later interview, he made this comment of like, I just put it out there and my followers know I do this all the time. But in this very specific instance, he shared this picture of a Cleveland Cavaliers celebration game. And he said that it was a rally for Donald Trump in Phoenix, Arizona. And 10 GOP picks up this image and shares it in his own tweet saying, you know, this is a picture of the Phoenix rally, but everyone said that, you know, Trump wasn't popular, but here's this empirical image right. proof. And so this picture, this tweet goes viral. He gets about 100,000 likes within the first couple of days. It gets retweeted by Kellyanne Conway and Donald Trump Jr. It gets picked up by some conservative media platforms as an example of pictures and proof that the Phoenix rally was really big. But then, of course, this, you know, the information comes out that this picture is actually of the Cleveland Cavaliers and not of the Phoenix rally. And it goes through the entire media cycle again, where after it's been reported on, liberal news organizations realize that it's a fake picture and they start tweeting about how conservatives got duped by this picture. Then you see stories coming out from Washington Post or Huffington Post talking about how conservatives were duped by this picture of, you know, the Cleveland Cavaliers. And this whole process, no one has realized that it's actually a Russian troll that's been sharing this information.
Yeah, I think people sometimes, they don't realize that the aim of the person, it's like the secondary aim of the person might have been to advance a certain political agenda, but the primary aim of the person was just to get attention, period. Yeah, and to upset people. And so in fact, getting it wrong is a mistake, but then debunking it the second time is a mistake because now it's actually giving the person more twice than what they thought they could have gotten. And certainly twice more than they ever deserved.
Right. And, you know, as a result of all of this coverage, 10 GOP jumped in followers at such a high amount because all of this happened so quickly, right? The tweet coming out, going viral, getting debunked, being covered for being debunked is happening in the span of a week. And 10 GOP's account name is coming up so frequently that they ended up getting a ton of followers after that whole incident. And so when I think about, you know, how easy is this kind of trading up the chain process? How easy can it be used? It's very, very exploitable now.
Yes. And I would say on top of it, the other thing that we talk about less is also it's like every one of those outlets incidentally exposed how dependent they were on kind of information. And then it makes it easier for that person or other people to do it again. And so now, yeah, let's say some other disinformation person is trying to get something out of the world. They're looking at what accounts were pivotal in kicking that off, and that's who they're targeting.
Yes,
with the next salacious photo,
exactly. That's who they're at mentioning or who they're now pitching to. And I still think pitching is still an important process. Like I think some of this information does come through social media, but I think pitching is still something that happens, especially when you're trying to direct message a journalist. Mm-hmm. So I think it's less so, you know, in 2011 or 2012, it was probably more popular to use emails versus now it's a lot of at mentioning individual journalists or DMing them or trying to contact them through a social media.
Their anonymous tip lines or their Signal channel. Yeah. They want to hear what's bubbling up and then they act as if they discovered it. And right. they never go like, oh, actually, you know, I never stopped to ask, why did this magically appear from three different sources within 10 minutes of each other in my DMs?
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, it's really a shame when you think about the like what it does in terms of the quality of information in the media ecology, right? And sometimes I wonder if these newsrooms realize in producing so much content that's not verified, you're just making the whole ecosystem so much worse.
It's a collective action problem for
Absolutely.
Sure. There's that Upton Sinclair line about how it's very difficult to get someone to understand something when their salary depends on them not understanding it. I feel like I talk about this a little bit in Trust Me, I'm Lying, where it's like you would never tolerate a journalist owning stock in a company they're reporting about, right? But what happens in this sort of clickbait universe or the universe where they are largely judged based on the numbers they put up is that the stock they own is in their own stories, right? Yeah. And so they don't stop and go, why is this magic? Like, why would someone gift me this scoop? You know, sources are inherently self-interested, but you're sort of deliberately blind to that self-interest because it aligns with your self-interest.
Self-interest. Yes, it aligns with your interest in getting attention for stories because that's what you depend on now as a journalist, right? And one of the things, one thing I will say is slightly different now compared to maybe about 10 years ago is to me the role of verified accounts and politicians in particular in making something look especially quality, like look as if it's quality information when in fact it's factually incorrect. And so one of the things that journalists look out for, in addition to does it have a lot of attention, the other thing they pay attention to is who is actually paying attention, right? And so if I tweet something and a well-known Democrat or Republican retweets it, obviously my own tweet's going to get much more attention, but now it has the potential for New York Times or CNN or Fox News to see it because it's been retweeted by a prominent politician and given this kind of verification check, regardless of whether it's accurate or not. And I think that's especially troubling when I look at, you know, election fraud discourse or COVID discourse, especially from Republican politicians, because some of them have a tendency to share that information.
The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite.
Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/stoic. That's netsuite.com/stoic.
Well, and I think increasingly, and you saw this with Matt, I think, what is it, Madison Cawthorn, the Republican senator from North Carolina, South Carolina, wherever. But he was saying, I don't see myself as a legislator. I don't have a legislative staff. I have a comms staff. And so that the line between individual and media outlet is also blurred.
So blurred.
With even fewer of the senses of obligation or ethics or, you know, sort of media. They are by definition wholly partisan, because they belong to a political party. And so they are seeing, they are acting like they are performing the social function of a media outlet with none of the constraints or obligations that yes. come with that, perhaps even to a larger audience than most media outlets.
Oh, absolutely. And then you think about people who are media personalities like Tucker Carlson, who claims he's not a news organization, but puts out information as having this semblance of news, right? And so the line between who is and isn't a quote unquote media person has become really blurred. And in a lot of situations, they can spread misinformation.
So there's two things I wanted to talk to you about. I'm not sure which one we should start with. Let's start with, sure. You were mentioning sort of bad misinformation actors or disinformation actors. Yeah. And they certainly exist. And we saw with the Russian interference, and we've seen it in clearly, like if you're China, the cost mm-hmm. of actually engaging in sort of real sabotage or overt violence is very high, but you can...
It's so cheap to hire trolls. It's
exactly.
It's so cheap to hire trolls.
And so it's unquestionable to me that is going on. And I've seen some of it going on. And I, you know, in my marketing days, people would approach mm-hmm. me to try to participate in said things. So I know that mm-hmm. that happens. But it strikes me much more in the last several years. I don't want to diminish that threat because it's certainly real. Sure. But it does seem like we're almost fighting the last war where we're just starting to come around to that existing. And now we're at the, I guess what I'm saying is it seems like a lot of the people spreading, let's say, COVID misinformation are not Russian trolls. They're just people who have been mentally infected with screwed up beliefs or like you're dealing with people who are genuinely sincere about the information they're spreading. And they're just wrong.
Yeah. And so this is a key distinction between disinformation and misinformation, right? So mm-hmm. disinformation is content that is intentionally shared that is knowingly false. So if I shared something on Twitter and I knew that it was false, that would be disinformation. But misinformation typically describes information you share that is false, but you don't know that it's false. So that could be me sharing some piece of COVID misinformation that I believe is true, but is actually factually incorrect. And I think what we're seeing now is this transition from disinformation really being a concern in 2016 to now the concern is really more related to misinformation and people really believing this content. And for me, that's a little bit scarier even because when you really, really believe something, it's hard to refute. And in a lot of situations, when you see people who are trying to combat COVID misinformation, for example, those folks will double down. And instead of, corrective information actually being helpful, it causes the individual who believes in the misinformation to dig their feet in and really, refute the correcting information.
Yeah, that's what I saw when I was doing Trust Me, I'm Lying. It's like, sometimes it's like, okay, very clearly this was a marketing message that bubbled up, that someone did this or a political message. But then oftentimes, like let's say with celebrity gossip or some rumor, you mm-hmm. like you trace it back and back and back and you go like, oh, this is from a typo, or this is just from a misinterpretation of a thing, where somebody got the date wrong on a photo, you're like, oh wow, it's like the tail is wagging the dog. Mm-hmm. Not like in the movie, there's a guy doing it, but like it's just like no, the machine is operating under its own power, and it takes only the slightest, sort of. Thought or post or whatever from one person to then be all over the place. And I don't know what you do about that.
I mean, I think the way that a lot of social media companies have attempted to address this is by really focusing on the content and not necessarily on the content producer, which kind of troubles me because it feels like if you're not going to remove the person who's sharing all this misinformation, if you're just going to remove it post by post, then you're still that person is plenty able to keep resharing bad information, right? And
yeah.
It's unfortunate because I feel like this is something that, social media companies can address this to some extent, but on some level, even if they, for example, get deplatformed or something, they get removed from a social media platform, they could just as easily go to a different social media account, right? And
right.
So in some of the QAnon stuff that I study, there was one interview a guy did where he mentioned that he had made upwards of 26 different Facebook accounts. Every time his account gets deleted, he makes a new one, shares the same type of COVID misinformation, gets removed, starts a new account, and does it all over again. And so, you know, with practices like that, I think it's really, really hard to figure out a way to actually get rid of this sort of misinformation.
And like, what is going on with that person? Like, is that person like, hey, I'm trying to destabilize society, I want people to die of a pandemic? Or is it more likely that that person just like, is severely convinced that they're doing the right thing?
Yeah. The way in which I've seen it framed in QAnon is that it's framed as a fight for good versus evil, where the person who is sharing this misinformation, they really believe that misinformation, and they believe that it is their obligation as an American and as a citizen to put that information out there, even though Big Brother or, you know, the cabal that they believe in will stop them from doing it.
Interesting. Yeah. So there's a Marcus Aurelius quote that I love, which he actually said during the Antonine Plague. So it's funny sort of how history works out. But he said, you know, he says, there's the type of plague that destroys your life and that kills you. And then he says, and then there's the pestilence that destroys your character. Right. Oh,
wow. And what a great quote.
I know. And it makes me wonder if there were people like that back then. These people who like, because every once in a while I'll post something, given that I know what I'm talking about, talk about misinformation, let's say, or right. I'll talk about our responsibility and obligation to each other.
Totally.
And you'll watch people respond, and they're so vehement and so intense and so sort of untethered from reality. My reaction has always been like, oh, this, like the person who mailed in that letter that I was talking about, it's like, oh, this person has been infected with something else, not COVID, but they've been infected with something that has taken, it's almost turned a parasite that has turned them into a host organism for like just putting out, like shedding whatever they were infected out into the world through as many means as possible.
Yes. And that's a really great way of framing it, because a lot of people kind of frame it in relation to cults, for example, and sort of brainwashing. But I think that doesn't necessarily capture the way in which this kind of misinformation spreads, right? Where you get this misinformation parasite and it compels you, right? It frames the world in a way that you become this digital soldier that has to provide this information, this critical information out there. And so even in a lot of these movements, they very much frame it as you're doing the right thing. And it really encourages you to engage in that kind of shedding process. And I was thinking a little bit about, you know, you were talking about, you know, the importance of social ties and relationships. And I think that's one of the most tragic consequences I've seen of this sort of misinformation parasite, is the severing of social ties between individuals. And there are a lot of situations, I think, of people who have cut ties with family and friends, especially when we talk about the vaccine and we talk about who has and hasn't gotten the vaccine.
Yeah, it's do you know about toxoplasmosis, the thing that cats carry?
No, I do not.
So there's like pregnant women, for instance, you're supposed to be careful about like having a cat that goes to the bathroom in your house, because they carry this virus or whatever that is particularly dangerous to pregnant women. But the way as I understand, the way the virus works is cats carry this parasite or I don't know if it's a virus or a parasite, but anyways, cats carry it. They give it to mice, and it makes mice not scared of cats. So you could see it as, it's like a biological weapon, like cats shed this thing and then mice get it. And then mice act recklessly and stupidly around cats, and then cats kill them. Right. And there's something like that in these things where, you know, they're not having a normal, like I have political opinions. I have things. I even have like crazy, not crazy. I have things that I'm suspicious of or skeptical of.
Sure.
Like we all do, but it doesn't consume my life in the way that I would then, you know, hound someone on social media or post or find myself storming the Capitol.
Oh,
right. So there's something that it infects and consumes the person to the degree where they're almost, I would argue, more dangerous than a paid Russian operative.
Oh yeah. Cause they
probably doesn't really care.
Yeah. Wait. Oh, absolutely. I think it's so different when you really, in your heart and your soul, you really believe it. Right. Because it means as a result of that, you might end up breaking social ties with people or engaging in violence, January 6th being a really excellent example. But there was another incident in Texas of someone recently like pulling a face mask off of a teacher.
A teacher, yeah.
Yes. And, you know, just like how absolutely reckless that is from just like a social standpoint, even, you know, if you don't believe in mask mandates and stuff like that, it's incredibly rude behavior.
Yeah, you're like a rabid dog. Like if I, yeah. like, let's say I believed X, Y, or Z religious garment was sinful. I'm like, that's your problem, right? Like I'm not going around ripping them off people unless I've been infected or like made antisocial to some degree by whatever is flowing through my head.
Yeah. And I think it is, you know, it becomes especially tragic when we think about those kind of social relationships, family and friends who no longer talk because of the vaccine. So for example, I'm engaged. And for my wedding next year, I expect everyone who can be vaccinated to be vaccinated.
Of course.
However, my mother-in-law is one of those vaccine skeptical people. And that has caused some just natural tension when we talk about, you know, wedding planning and that sort of thing, because I really want her to get the vaccine. And she's right now she's more on the skeptical side of things and not the conspiratorial side of things, thankfully.
Sure.
Like she doesn't believe in the microchip stuff. She's just more skeptical of its effectiveness, which I think, you know, those sort of folks are easier to persuade. Those who are vaccine skeptical versus people who are just straight up conspiratorial. But it has caused a lot of strain in our family because she refuses to get vaccinated. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with the subreddit QAnon Casualties.
Yes.
So I find that particular subreddit really interesting because of just the kind of stories that emerge and the ways in which this kind of misinformation can not just impact like our national politics or, you know, things that are going on politically or socially in public, but also our deeply personal private lives, right? Like just the idea that you're no longer speaking to individuals because they refuse to get vaccinated.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. A friend of mine's wife is like a sort of a rabid anti like COVID denier, vaccine denier, mass denier. And she posts about it on social media like all the time.
Right.
And like we sort of know objectively it's a fringe belief, right? So you, let's say 1,000 people see each one of these posts, you know, 900 of them or 950 of them are all like, this is insane. And like 50 are probably like, oh, you have a good point, right?
Yeah.
But the weird part about it is like, nobody says anything. I don't say anything. Nobody says anything because I think we're all, I was curious, that was what I was going to ask you, is like, what is our obligation as individuals? What's my obligation as a person?
What do we owe to each other? Yeah.
Yeah. Or what's my, as a content creator, like with Daily Stoke, we have 1 million Instagram followers. So we'll post something. I've posted that Marcus Aurelius quote that we were talking about earlier. And it will be, you could look at it. It's thousands of comments from people who are like, this is not true. How could you say this? You know, made this quote up. Marcus Aurelius would never wear a mask. He's not a cuck. You know, all this crazy shit, basically.
Yeah.
What is my, like, I'm curious, like, what is our obligation? Do you let it sit? Do you have to fight each one? Do you, like, it makes me unhappy when I see it. Can I just ignore it? What do you feel like our obligation is as people who are also nodes in this informational ecosystem?
Yeah. And that's such a great and hard question, especially when you have such a large audience like that, right? I think just from a human perspective, it'd be really hard for you or a producer to respond to each and every single comment in a meaningful, effective way, right? And so I think the trick is picking your battles, which is a lot easier said than done. But for me, folks who are really close to me, I think are the ones that I try to persuade the most often, like, you know, my future mother-in-law. I think when it comes to a larger audience, it's much harder to respond. And I think when you know that the person is not engaging in genuine deliberative discourse, then it's not worth the effort. So if someone's calling you a cuck for, you know, posting a link or something, you're like, I'm probably not going to have healthy political conversations with you. There's not really an exchange of ideas or information in a meaningful way because you're coming into that conversation knowing that person isn't genuinely trying to talk to you. They're just trying to insult you.
Yeah. My usual policy is ban, or you can restrict accounts so they can't post on your thing anymore. But
Yeah. And I think that's the way to go for a lot of these, especially if they're not engaging in genuine conversation. And I think that's what's really hard about social media. Social media is really great for trading up the chain and for, you know, getting really polarizing, emotionally laden content to go viral. But it's less good for those nuanced conversations, unless you're, you know, in a private message or something with someone, because a lot of social media is so public in nature. If I have an argument with someone on Facebook, everyone sees that. And so I'm not just arguing to the person back and forth, but I'm arguing to the person knowing there's an audience that I'm trying to persuade, right? I want to make sure that my message or my comment gets more likes or whatever compared to the other person. And I think that that naturally just alters the way in which people talk to one another, because it becomes about winning and not so much about exchanging information or persuading someone that this misinformation is incorrect.
I did a piece for the New York Daily News about sort of banning these different types of people and the failures of the platforms. Because to me, there's kind of an analogy to like the bill of goods we've been sold, like in regards to recycling or your carbon footprint, where like we as individuals go like, am I reusing this bottle? Am I recycling? As if that, or, you know, we're like, oh, we got to stop using plastic straws, even though that's like 0.001% of the global pollution. Like, it's basically like these massive companies that are raping the earth have somehow managed to flip the obligation. So it's the individual using a microscopic amount of, you know, pollution material. They're having to think about rationing their activities and paring down what they're doing. It's almost as if it's a massive distraction from what they're, it's like, should you have to what's my obligation to my friend's wife when really Facebook, you know, I think the question is Facebook's obligation to billions of people?
Yes. And, you know, this is something that I think Facebook is only really thinking about in relation to their bottom line, which is incredibly tragic, right? Mm-hmm. Like, this is only a concern for Mike Zuckerberg because lots and lots of people have called him out on it. And honestly, I don't know if Facebook will change anything unless they start seeing a lower amount of users or, you know, really significant backlash, which is really tragic when you think about, you know, the potential or the importance of a platform like Facebook in spreading that sort of misinformation.
Well, yeah, I think these infected people are very good for business because they care so much more.
And they post so much more. Right. They care so much more. They post so much more. They're reacting to one another's comments, right? I think this is a really key difference when you join a misinformation community like that, when you are, you know, you believe that Bill Gates has implanted this microchip in the COVID vaccine and you find a community of people who believe the same things you do. It's not just that you're posting the content, it's that they're reacting to it, they're responding, they're cheering you on. And all of that looks like, you know, activity on social media and on Facebook. And it does well for Facebook in the, you know, in the short sense of I am getting a lot of people who are really active on these platforms. But at the same time, you know, it is also spreading a ton of misinformation.
My last question for you, and this is a weird thing that I've gone through with the book. So my intention for writing the book was to reveal how some of these things work with the idea that they might be fixed, right? Or to bring them to people's attention. So sometimes people, when I've taken COVID very seriously, I obviously support vaccines. I've tried to use my platform to talk about these ideas. People will sometimes go, how is you, the person who wrote Trust Me, I'm Lying, could you possibly believe what the media is telling you about these things? Which is the question I wanted to pose to you, which is like, when you watch things get traded up the chain all over the place, like even all the way up to the New York Times or to CNN or to all sorts of media outlets, including the so-called reputable ones. It is an interesting question. How then do we trust, you know, when they say, you know, the election was, there was no fraud in the election, or they say, you know, COVID is real, or they say masks work. There is this, it is a tricky problem because we are, even people who distrust the media, including myself, from my experiences, or for you, having seen the vulnerabilities in the system, we are still dependent on the media to get our information.
Yeah. And I think that's not only is that a hard, important question, but it's true for a lot of aspects of our society, right? Even just thinking about the medical system, like, you know, a lot of people are unhappy with their healthcare system for a lot of reasons. And the healthcare system has not been great to everyone, particularly, you know, Black and Indigenous people of color and minorities.
And they've gotten so many things wrong, and they've lied about it when they've gotten wrong. Like, that's a, you can't dispute that.
Yeah. And yet, you know, it makes sense to me that, that as a result of that, folks are skeptical of the vaccine, right? And I think that ends up becoming a potential funnel for conspiratorial thoughts and that sort of thing. But going back to the question that you had, how do we balance that? I think it's not, you know, for me, it's not a matter of trusting media outright, but situating media information in relation to all of the other information in the ecosystem. So to use COVID as an example, I think news media, there's only so much that news media organizations can do when they're writing stories about COVID, because there's only so much space that you can put into a news article, right? Even if you have hundreds of news articles. So for me, knowing that it's medical information, I try to rely on a combination of news organizations, information, and information from medical associations, for example. And my hope is that if I'm triangulating information, it is an improved quality. But of course, I still do all of that with many, many grains of salt.
Yeah, no, it's hard because I think that's what's so insidious about that do your own research phrase, because that is what you should be doing. I don't think some people actually know what research entails.
Yeah. And I think what's really tricky about that, especially for anyone, is just how time consuming it is. In the past, when we had fewer social media, or we had fewer platforms, media platforms in general, you know, it was, there's not as much content for a person to have to sift and winnow through. Now, that being said, that means you have to put a lot of trust in the media organizations that are producing the information, and there are issues related to that. But now I think we're seeing a total different flip side, where in the past, the onus was on the media organization to be trustworthy. Now the onus is on the audience to make sure that we are constantly verifying that information. And it's exhausting. It's really, really exhausting. I think it was one of your previous podcast episodes where you were talking about your media consumption and the fact that you don't necessarily do that much breaking news, but you try to, you know, follow along stories that are kind of longer or kind of after, right?
Yeah.
And I think those kind of practices are really, really useful. And I will probably actually take some of that advice into account, because I consume way too much news and way too much social media. But in doing so, you get a lot of fatigue, right? You get fatigue from the influx of information, and it makes it even harder to verify that information.
Well, I think you want to, read John Barry's The Great Influenza to understand what's happening today, as opposed to reading Alex Berenson's nonsense tweets about it, right? Like, who you want to study the past to help you understand the future. I think, you know, so sometimes people go like, you know, Ryan, you wrote this book about fake news. How could you believe the fake news about Donald Trump? And I think it's like, well, I'm actually not believing the fake news about Donald Trump. I'm reading his direct quoted words, right? Yeah. Like, it's like the media can be very biased and very incorrect and be vulnerable in all these ways that it could have fixed by now that it doesn't, for largely financial as opposed to ideological reasons, and still be correct on certain things that are demonstrable and verifiable that you can check for yourself.
Absolutely. And I think that's what, like, when we talk about folks not necessarily realizing what doing the research means, to me, a really important aspect of doing the research is going straight to the source, right? And if you're going to have if you're going to consume some news article about a new policy or election fraud or whatever, going to the source and seeing what election officials said and what they reported is really, really essential, I think, in doing your research.
And the source is not your friend's cousin's partner who is in the FBI or the, you know, the CDC or something. It's actually direct interaction with people who know what they're talking about.
Yes. And I, you know, one of the things that I do feel like I've seen a lot when folks are talking about misinformation, especially misinformation that trades up the chain. I'm always super skeptical of anything that is kind of conspiratorial language, like anything that says, you know, this larger body is doing something terrible. And I think with a lot of information, it's very easy for something to turn from skepticism into conspiracy. And so when folks are talking about doing the research, I always try to steer them away from that skepticism conspiracy link and move them in more of a different direction. Because usually once you start getting into that conspiratorial belief structure, that's where things really, you know, hits the fan.
When I think asking, like, what is the agenda? Cicero said, qui bono, like, who benefits, mm-hmm, right? That's the question that you ask. And so it's like, when you're reading an article from an emergency room doctor in Alabama, who's not in the media, who's not a reporter, who's not a public person, it's very obvious why, like, that they would have little to no agenda here, and that they are giving you, they're not even giving you political view, but they're just trying to give you the facts on the ground. We contrast this with the number one spreader of COVID misinformation, this guy in Florida. It's like, this is like a quack doctor with no patients who sells expensive products on the internet to his email list. Like, you know, you should be able to decide, vet sources accordingly. But I think that's one of the things I realized is like, oh, what we're talking about, this is actually a, like, we used to think the digital divide was access to information, not access to information.
Right.
I think it's the set of skills that allow you to navigate an overwhelming amount of information and make sense of it. A lot of people don't have the skills or time to do that. A lady down the street who refused to get the vaccine, she died. She ran a small food truck here. And like her last words were like, you know, please, everyone get vaccinated. But I think about, like, she's sitting in a food truck all day, you know, making tacos. She doesn't have the time to dick around checking stories against each other, or nor was she given the skills that, you know, you and I were trained at university to have.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, media literacy, I feel, is becoming a really, really essential skill set that every citizen needs to have. And yet, you know, the places and people who would be able to teach media literacy, libraries, schools, are becoming increasingly inaccessible. They're losing a lot of funding. And it's really unfortunate, because those are the skills I feel are really necessary to do that sort of sifting and winnowing of information, or to ask the really important questions like, you know, what does a person get by sharing this information? And the example that you provided, I think, is really stellar, because for me, anytime someone is hawking or selling something, that signals to me the intent is not about providing genuine information. Alex Jones being a great example of that.
No, of course. Although it's funny, people with me go, oh, you're just saying this to, like, make money. It's like, I don't think you understand. By pissing you off, it's costing me money.
Money,
right?
Yeah.
So you should also, when you go, does the person benefit from saying this? Or is, by saying it, you know, is it actually, like, you can, it's a counter signal that you can trust it more because it's not in their self-interest. Although, to go to what we're talking about with misinformation, it also could be that the person has now been red-pilled, or, you know, their mind is so screwed up that now they are actively, they're acting contrary to their interests, and it's so hard to tell.
It is. And I think that's especially hard when you think about social media content, especially the stuff that's super unverifiable. Mm-hmm. So some of the type of stuff that I see often go viral are things like, you know, here's a picture of someone getting sick because of the vaccine, and nobody will share this, right? And there's both the kind of really salient image and then this kind of text, this message, and no one will share it, be a patriot and share it, or something like that. And that sort of information is really hard to engage in that verification process. Like, how do you find the people who originally shared that picture? And it's been shared and manipulated so many times, it's probably quite tricky to find.
Yeah, it's crazy. Well, I do think media literacy is the next thing. There was some country that's right next to Russia. I forget which country it was. Finland, maybe. They were talking about like all kids for decades have been taught media literacy because they've so been worried about the threat of misinformation from emanating from the Soviet Union and now Russia, that it's just part of the lifestyle. I think that's where we're going to have to get as a society.
I would love that. I think Finland is this state that they do media literacy also from a very young age, which I think is really essential. Like, you know, if you're teaching media literacy to someone who's in their 40s or 50s, you have to really engage in an unlearning and learning process, right? Like undoing the habits that you developed for information gathering and then rebuilding new habits. Whereas if you're starting from primary school or elementary school, you're really teaching them as they're growing up and starting to consume information in the real world. And I think the earlier that we start, the better it is.
No, that's right. I think, you know, talking about your mother-in-law, I think about my own parents. I kind of sometimes it's too late for them, you know, and let's just focus on the next generation, sadly.
Absolutely. Well, and we know that a lot of misinformation actors and conspiracy theorists do also target children, right? They, like my mother-in-law, has a lot of children that she interacts with, you know, her grandkids and things like that. And, you know, what I think about those audiences or when I think about those kids, my greatest hope for them is that they gain the media literacy skills to question that. But I don't know if they're necessarily getting that from people who have misinformation in their lives.
No, I think that is the alarming thing. Welcome to Austin. I'm out in Bastrop, so not far from you.
Oh, cool. So this is actually my first time living in the South. Do you have any tips or suggestions?
Like, you mean about how to live in the South or things to do in the South?
More the former, both in terms of, you know, so I'm originally from New York City, and then I did my PhD in Wisconsin, which is where I met my fiance.
Yeah.
And this is both of our first times really living in the South and dealing with the weather and, you know, living in a Southern state and all of the kind of political implications of
that. Have you been here for a full year, or is this, did you get here for the summer?
So we came in, this is actually our full year as of this week. So we moved around this time in 2020. So we've lived in Austin for a year, but it's been all under the pandemic, right? And so we haven't actually seen anything, or we haven't really explored Texas or even Austin, really.
Well, and Austin is the South, but it's sort of the functional South. So, you know, like I'm from California, so I moved to New Orleans. That was my first Southern city. Mm-hmm. And when I was writing my first book, actually, and it was wonderful, but we sort of wanted a place that was also functional, like where people had jobs and, you know, like, worked at big companies and there was an IKEA and stuff, you know, like we wanted like actual life. So we sort of split the difference and found Austin. So this is a nice place to get your feet wet for the South, because it's got a lot of the wonderful parts of the South with fewer of the, crazy parts of the
South. Yeah. Yes. No, absolutely. And then of course I'm an Asian woman, and
yes,
one of the really interesting things I think about moving to Austin and moving to the South was just how few Asian Americans there are, or at least, like, you know, I came here thinking there weren't that many, but I feel like with the increasing number of folks who are transplanting to Austin, that number is potentially growing.
It's strange how siloed Texas is. Like, Houston's like, I think, the most diverse city in America. And then I would venture to guess that Austin is one of the, Austin is not only not super diverse, but it's also very segregated. Not just from original segregation, but just, it seems very siloed, and it's hard to know if there are more people like you, whatever you are. It's hard to know where those people are necessarily.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. And I didn't realize how segregated the city was until, you know, we actually moved here. And I realized, like, a lot of that segregation is access to highways and that sort of thing. And that was, you know, New York has certainly some segregated portions, but not to the degree that I felt it was here in Austin.
Yeah, you're just all up on top of each other in different cities. And then I think, and in Texas especially, you're like, we're all inside our cars. So you're not really even though you are intermingling, you're intermingling on a 5-lane highway. So you're not actually getting the sense that you're in a sea of diverse people.
Well, and especially I realize now, and, you know, being in the summer, the reason why everyone's in their car is because it's just too darn hot outside.
That is very true. And I've got to imagine, with the campus only sort of being partially like, this isn't sort of full blown college town Austin that you've experienced, which is more diverse and welcoming and cosmopolitan, I feel like.
Yes. And it is, you know, we're actually about to start our new semester this next week. And, I'm I really want to see what that culture is like when everyone is together, but I'm also really anxious because, you know, living in Texas, there are no mask mandates or vaccine yes. mandates. And so I think the rollout in terms of, you know, how is the university going to address COVID while still trying to create this semblance of a college environment is going to be really tricky.
Well, so I live out more in the country than you do. And it's wonderful. And I've sort of, people go, so what is it like? And it's, I sort of go, the nice part is you can do whatever you want. the not nice part is that everyone can do whatever they want. And yeah. you realize that we have very divergent senses of what the right thing is and what, like, what this, I mean, I think Texas is struggling with, and you were just alluding to, is mm-hmm. is that we seem to have a very poor understanding of what the word freedom is, or we have a perverse understanding of what the word freedom means.
Yes, that's a really good way to frame it. I think the concept of freedom, it hasn't just been perverse, but has been exploited and manipulated, right? So that it means different things to different people. And it's a little unfortunate because I feel like, you know, one of the things that has become separated is this concept of freedom and caring for one another, right? Yes. And this idea that they can be kind of diametrically opposed. It's very, you know, it's quite tragic, particularly in Texas, especially given the rising rates with the Delta variant.
Well, and it's profoundly disingenuous, right? So the governor will say stuff like, you know, the way through this virus is through personal responsibility. And you're like, totally agree. That is obviously the way through it. And so you're like, if that's where the sentence stopped, you know, or the statement stopped, if it was like, hey, everyone is responsible for doing their part to stop this virus, you'd be like, great. But then the Texas seems to have, again, perverted this idea of freedom where it's like, it's about personal responsibility, not mandates. And then out of the other side of their mouth or the second half of the sentence is, by the way, you don't actually have any responsibility and you don't have to do anything that you don't want to do, which is, of course, not what personal responsibility means. So it's like, if you're saying, hey, vaccines are a personal choice, masks are a personal choice, but I expect each and every one of you to make the personally responsible choice, right. At least that's a coherent policy that's logically consistent, as opposed to, you know, this is about freedom and responsibility. And by the way, you're free to do whatever you want and you have no responsibility.
Yes, exactly. And I think that's the distinction, right, between freedom and responsibility, and what does responsibility actually mean? Because being responsible means you should be wearing masks and you should be getting vaccinated, but especially given the sheer amount of misinformation out there about the vaccine, the message coming from the governor and from a lot of politicians here in Texas has been really troubling.
Well, I'm so glad we got to talk. Please keep up the very important work.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me, Ryan.
My newest book, Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave, is now available for pre-order. We've got a bunch of amazing bonuses. You can get signed copies, of course. I'm so proud of this book. General Jim Mattis has called it a superb handbook for crafting a purposeful life. Matthew McConaughey, also a father, called it an urgent call to arms to each and all of us. I do hope you check it out. It's my first in the Four Virtues series, Courage, Temperance, Justice, Wisdom. Courage is Calling, Fortune Favors the Brave. If you want to pre-order it, I'd really appreciate your support. Go to dailystoic.com/pre-order. Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts.
You know, if I would have applied myself, I could have gone to the NBA.
You think so?
Yeah, I think so. But it's just like, it's been done. You know, I didn't want to, I was like, I don't want to be a follower. Hi, I'm Jason Concepcion.
And I'm Shea Serrano. And we are back. We have a new podcast from Wondery. It's called Six Trophies.
Woo!
And it's the f***ing best.
Each week, Shea Serrano and I are combing through all the NBA storylines, finding the best, most interesting, most compelling stories, and then handing out six pop culture themed trophies for six basketball related activities.
Trophies like the Dominant Dominic Toretto I Live My Life a Quarter Mile at a Time trophy, which is given to someone who made a short-term decision with no regard for future consequence.
Or the Christopher Nolan Tenet trophy, which is given to someone who did something that we didn't understand.
Catalina Wine Mixer trophy.
Ooh, the Lauryn Hill You Might Win Some But You Just Lost One trophy. And what's more, the NBA playoffs are here, so you want to make Six Trophies your go-to companion podcast through all the craziness. Follow Six Trophies on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. Listen ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.
Do you want to hear about the $100 wedding dress that just saved Abercrombie?
Or the tech acquisition that was just like Game of Thrones?
Or the one financial equation that can solve climate change?
Then check out our daily podcast, The Best One Yet, or as we call it, T-Boy.
This is Nick.
This is Jack.
And we pick the three most interesting business news stories every day for the perfect mix.
20 minutes each morning, you're going to feel brighter.
We call it Pop Biz, don't we, Jack?
Where pop culture meets business news. So whether you want to kick off a conversation with your buddies,
or you're going for that promotion at work,
or you just want to know the trends before your friends,
feel brighter by starting your morning with us every weekday.
Listen to The Best One Yet on the Wondery app or wherever you get your pods.
You can listen to The Best One Yet ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts.
With shows like The Best One Yet, How I Built This, and many more, Wondery means business.